Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today, we've got some important national news about the Department of Justice's landmark decision to stop using private prisons. We'll also tell you about some new bills in the California legislature to reform the Public Utilities Commission. We'll have a public service announcement for residents of Lemon Grove about a new workshop coming up on the city's downtown plans. Then on Green Scene, here are some bright new ideas for producing solar energy from windows. We'll have information about a bill by San Diego State Senator Marty Block that would help bring legal services to low-income people. The Mexican Consul will be in Lemon Grove, and if you're a Mexican person living in the United States and you need assistance, we'll have some information on how you can get that this Saturday. Then on Bookshelf, we have a special treat for you today. Raina Menashe will be introducing author and wordsmith extraordinaire Charles Harrington Elster. We'll also tell you about how you can get GPS free from the county for Alzheimer's patients. We'll have all these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. So stay tuned, and we hope you'll enjoy the show. Private, for-profit prisons are more dangerous and less effective than government-run prisons, a new report by the U.S. Justice Department's Office of Inspector General concludes. Based on those findings, last week, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates announced that the U.S. Justice Department will be reducing and ultimately ending its use of privately operated prisons. The use of private prisons began as a response to the federal prison population growing by nearly 800% between 1980 and 2013, in part due to mandatory sentencing laws. By 2013, 15% of all federal prisoners, or about 30,000 inmates, were in private prisons. By December of last year, however, that number had dropped to 22,000 due to recent reforms. According to the Inspector General's report, the Federal Bureau of Prisons spends hundreds of millions of dollars every year on outsourcing convicts to for-profit prisons. But in recent years, disturbances in several federal contract prisons resulted in extensive property damage, bodily injury, and death of a correctional officer. That report analyzed 14 contract prisons and found they were worse than government-run prisons in most categories, including higher rates of assaults by inmates, contraband seized, and lockdowns. The report also found that prisoners were thrown into solitary confinement without justification for extensive periods, a violation of federal rules. Some inmates were even denied basic medical care. A riot at one private prison over poor quality food and medical care led to 20 injuries and death of a guard. The announcement by the Justice Department to drop private prisons came after Mother Jones magazine published an epic 35,000-word investigative report by a journalist who went undercover as a private prison guard for 4 months at a prison in Louisiana run by Corrections Corporation of America. His report revealed a pattern of guards engaging in or turning a blind eye to violence, abuse, and neglect. One prisoner, who had 9 requests for medical care denied, lost both legs and 2 fingers to gangrene. There was no full-time psychiatrist for 15,000 inmates at the facility. The company also cut corners on food, medicine, and even security costs to maximize profits. One prisoner escaped while the guard towers were unmanned. Halting use of private prisons by the Department of Justice won't happen instantly, but existing contracts will not be renewed, or they will be substantially reduced, according to Yates. Private prisons are used, however, by other federal agencies, including Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which has a detention center in Otay Mesa locally, run by Corrections Corporations of America. Yes, the same private prison contractor exposed for allowing horrific abuses in the Mother Jones expose. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont called Thursday's announcement an important first step, but he says it's not enough. He states, "We must insist that these changes are adopted by all federal agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security, which relies heavily on private prisons even for housing vulnerable women and children. Incarceration should not be a for-profit business," Senator Leahy concludes, the Los Angeles Times reports. Some states also rely on private prisons, including California. Currently, California has about 6,000 state prisoners in two privately operated correctional centers in Arizona and Mississippi to relieve prison overcrowding. The state also has two prisons run by private contractors here in California, one run by the GEO Group and the other by Corrections Corporation of America. The Prison Policy Initiative has been working to end private prisons and led a successful effort to get the University of California system to divest from investments in private prison corporations last year. But the group calls the Department of Justice decision to close down up to 13 private prisons a band-aid approach, noting that the U.S. has the highest incarceration rate of any nation in the world, with 2.3 million Americans behind bars, many for relatively minor offenses, and the group is calling for additional prison reforms. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Governor Jerry Brown and Assemblyman Mike Gatto, chair of the Assembly Utilities and Commerce Committee, have announced an agreement to extensively reform the California Utilities Commission to improve how the state's utility regulators service the public. The CPUC has been riddled by scandals in recent years, including revelations that some commissioners engaged in illegal backdoor dealings or ex parte communications with the utilities they were supposed to regulate, including discussions on the deadly San Bruno pipeline explosion and charging ratepayers for shutdown costs of the San Onofre nuclear facilities. The reform package negotiated with the administration includes provisions to create an independent ethics ombudsperson whom any CPUC employee or member of the public can contact. The ombudsperson will also be responsible for ethics training of all CPUC commissioners and staff on everything from gift and travel ethics to ex parte communication compliance. The reforms, if passed by the legislature, would also create a deputy executive director for safety with absolute authority to red flag any unsafe facility, process, or activity. Cross-agency training procedures would also be set up with other agencies. The measure will also transfer several transportation and enforcement responsibilities of the CPUC to the California State Transportation Agency, such as oversight of airport shuttles, moving truck companies, transportation network companies, and charter buses. In addition, the California Research Bureau will be required to conduct a comprehensive study by January 1, 2018, to assess whether the CPUC's telecommunications functions should be transferred to another agency with an emphasis on consumer services as a top priority. Assemblyman Gatto states, "The reforms in this package overhaul the CPUC and subject it to more transparent, good government principles. It will now be able to focus on the things that are most important to Californians and our communities, safety, the environment, and keeping utility rates low." He concludes, "These three pieces of legislation are just the beginning to restoring the public's trust in our commission." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Kim Cooney.
This is Miriam Raftery with a public service announcement. The Mexican Consul General will be holding a mobile consulate at the Lemon Grove Library on Saturday, August 27th from 8 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Mexican people living in the United States can set an appointment for assistance with passports and consular identifications. The consul's office also issues birth certificates and gives advice on other issues such as health, immigration, and financial education. To make an appointment, you can call 1-877-639-4835. And for more information, you can visit consulmexsd.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Jonathan Getz with the Green Scene Report. What if glass skyscrapers and even ordinary-looking glass windows in your home could be transformed into solar energy production centers? There are an estimated 5 million skyscrapers and tall towers in the U.S., which consume a whopping 40% of America's electrical power. That's about 430 million square feet of windows. Now, Solar Window Technologies has developed an invisible system to transport electricity through solar electric generating. Solar Window says the system could pay for itself in just 1 year on a typical 50-story building, The company claims its solar window can outperform rooftop solar 50 to 1. Here's how it works. The solar window generates electricity when transparent organic coatings are applied in thin layers onto glass surfaces. A system of invisible wires half the width of a human hair transport electricity across the surface to the edge of the glass where it connects to the building's electrical systems. The prospect of a transparent electricity-generating window that utilizes this virtually invisible system for transporting is especially attractive to architects, designers, and building occupants in tall towers and skyscrapers. Solar window coatings can be applied to clear glass without obscuring views and are also available in colored tints. Unlike conventional systems, solar window can be applied to all four sides of tall towers, generating electricity using natural and artificial light conditions and even shaded areas. Though not yet on the market, the company says it's gearing up for rapid production to meet demand. Don't have a skyscraper? Here's a bright idea. The company also has residential solar windows, including French paint styles that can turn any homeowner into an electric power producer. To learn more about this promising new solar option, visit www.solarwindow.com.
A bill requiring law students to complete 50 hours of supervised volunteer or pro bono service before taking the bar exam now goes to the governor after the state Senate voted late Monday to approve changes made in the assembly. Senate Bill 1257 by San Diego Senator Marty Block will provide law students with hands-on experience in addition to classroom theory before they go on to practice law, and provide poor Californians with new resource for legal assistance. Block says that representing low-income clients might also spur law student interests in high-need, but relatively low-paid fields of law. Acceptable volunteer service under the bill would include work that benefits the public interest or persons who are poor or of modest means. Partisan political activities would not qualify as pro bono service. In the assembly, the bill was amended to allow students to receive payment for their work, as long as payment was not from the client who benefited from the service. Students who are already licensed in foreign countries or other states are exempt from the bill. Senator Block says, SB 1257 will provide practical experience for law students, legal assistance for needy Californians, and staff support for organizations that already represent the underserved. SB 1257 is supported by the Conference of California Bar Association and was approved by the Senate on a 26-12 vote. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Jacob Myers.
This is Miriam Raftery with a public service announcement. The Mexican Consul General will be holding a mobile consulate at the Lemon Grove Library on Saturday, August 27th from 8 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Mexican people living in the United States can set an appointment for assistance with passports and consular identifications. The consul's office also issues birth certificates and gives advice on other issues such as health, immigration, and financial education. To make an appointment, you can call 1-877-639-4835. And for more information, you can visit consulmexsd.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Charles Harrington Elster, seasoned writer, broadcaster, narrator, and nationally recognized wordsmith. My guest is the author of 11 books, including the popular vocabulary building program, Verbal Advantage, and his latest written and audiobook, Word Workout. My guest is especially known for coming up with the novel approach to SAT and ACT test preparation, and he's published articles in the New York Times Magazine, the Boston Globe, and the Wall Street Journal. He's a well-respected member of the San Diego literary community, and he was my first mentor in the writing field, as it happens. So welcome, Charlie. It's a pleasure seeing you again and having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you, Raina. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, let's go back a ways here. You and I originally met at the Writer's Bookstore in Haven a long, long time ago. How did you get to San Diego from New York in the first place, and what was your involvement with that store?
I followed my college sweetheart from Yale out here because she grew up in National City.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she was the second person in 50 years to go to an Ivy League school from Sweetwater High School.
Wow, really?
Yeah, so she said, look, I'm going home to my turf and you're welcome to come. Uh-huh. So I said, okay, go west, young man. Let's see what California looks like. And San Diego just took a hold of me. Mm-hmm. I came out in 81 and my first job was editing an audio-visual interactive, computer interactive program, a vocabulary building program for a company called K-Pro Computers in Solana Beach. I don't know if you remember that company, but they were one of the first companies to come out with a PC. And then IBM took over and, you know, that was sort of the end of that story. But I got very involved in words doing mm-hmm. that job. And that led me to first to KPBS Radio, mm-hmm. where I had a segment called A Word to the Wise, just two to three minute rants about language. And then that led me to the Writer's Bookstore in Haven, which was in my neighborhood, Kensington, in Normal Heights. And I got to know the owners there, Betty Juris and Nancy Painter, and I eventually got a contract for my first book. And they said, you know what, would you like to teach a workshop? And so I started teaching the open workshop at the Writer's Haven. And that's how I met you and a bunch of other people that I've kept in touch with over the years.
It was a special bookstore. It was a special place. For those who don't remember, can you paint us a picture of what that the Writer's Bookstore in Haven was like?
Well, I think the first thing that people would notice if they were to go in a time travel machine and go to the Writer's Haven would be, as they walked in the door, this place is full of cigarette smoke. I was a smoker then.
Right.
It's been over 20 years since I quit, but, you know, everybody, it seemed, in that store who hung out there smoked, and that was allowed then. And it seemed as if they were doing a lot more smoking than writing, to me. You know, and the funny thing was that the people who tended to come to my workshop weren't smokers. So there I was blowing secondhand smoke at them. And that was my main impression. But it was a nice group of people. It was a very diverse group of people. And some of them have gone on to be successful writers.
Yeah, I remember your workshop very well. It was a very important workshop in my life.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it was one of the first workshops I'd gone to as an adult. I'd been writing since I was a little kid. And I was very young, and I remember being eviscerated by a workshop member who was much older and was very unkind. And I remember I was about to walk out and stop writing. I was so discouraged. And you came up to me and you said, you know, a real writer entered the bookstore tonight. Don't stop. And I came back, and that person who eviscerated me turned out to be a future friend and a workshop colleague. And I learned how to not take it personally and how to take, you know, to take what works and to dismiss what doesn't. But that workshop was, it was the barometer for everything that followed. It was very, very helpful. So after all these years, I remember it.
That's a nice story. I like to think that when I led that workshop, I was trying to make it the most democratic environment mm-hmm. possible without anybody saying ad hominem things about other people's work. You know, you talk about the work.
Right.
Not about the person.
Right.
Or the person you think is in the work.
Right.
So it was very important to me as the leader to make sure that everything was very equal and very mm-hmm. fair, equitable, mm-hmm. and that everybody felt encouraged no matter what they chose to write. Because we had all kinds. It was the open workshop. We had romance writers, mystery writers, straight fiction writers. You had everybody, nonfiction writers, everybody imaginable. And the funny thing for me was that, and maybe this is why I was more comfortable as a leader than a participant, I never have felt comfortable having my work critiqued in a workshop.
It's ironic.
Yeah, isn't it? It's strange. I'm a very lonely and individualistic kind of writer, and I don't even show my stuff to anybody else before it goes to my editor or whatever. I have a wall in my office with writers' cartoons that I've clipped from The New Yorker mostly and framed. And one of them is a guy sitting on the couch with his manuscript and his wife is standing at the door and she says, well, and I'm saying this only because I'm your wife, it stinks.
Wow.
So I don't even show my stuff to my wife, you know, because I don't want to hear that.
Right. You don't want to hear it. Well, you're smart not to show it if you don't want to hear it. Right. You need to be ready, right?
You
send it to the publisher.
You have to, you know, and the funny thing is that it doesn't matter how hard you try to avoid criticism as a writer, you're going to get
it.
And you're going to get it from all corners, and you're going to get the bad stuff, and you're going to get the good stuff.
Right.
So you just have to be ready. I mean, we always talk about rejection as being part of the writer's life. But it's the criticism that hurts more, I think, because, you know, in the days of Amazon, where anybody can write a review, no credentials required, doesn't go through an editor, and it stays online in perpetuity. There's no way to take it off.
And it can be vicious.
It can be stupid. It can be illiterate. And it's terrible. I mean, thank goodness I have mostly 5-star reviews on Amazon, but it hurts.
Right.
It hurts. Even after 30 years in the business, somebody stupid says something stupid about your book and it hurts.
Right. Let's talk about your books. I know your first book was There Is No Zoo in Zoology.
Ah, well, now I have a willing victim here. I came up with the title because there is no zoo in zoology.
Okay. I really fell for that one, huh?
Yeah, seriously. And other beastly mispronunciations. It's a great title, and it led after my second book to a compilation. I took the first two books on pronunciation, and I put them together in the big book of beastly mispronunciations, the complete guide for the opinionated speaker. It's very opinionated.
I draw a fine line,
you know, and you can say, well, okay, I agree or I don't, but at least I'm reading one man's informed opinion, and I can make up my own mind. But, yeah, zoology, just to finish the lesson on that, you need 3 O's in that word if you're going to pronounce it zoology.
Okay. I learned something. Thank you. But tell me, I want to learn why you went this way with your gifts of language, of pronunciation. I mean, you could have I know you teach, but you could have specialized in that. You could have written many, many different things, and maybe you will go on to write in a different area. But what attracted you to become a professional lover of words?
I guess we call ourselves, professional word lovers, we call ourselves language mavens. And that's kind of a nod of appreciation to the late William Safire, who wrote the On Language column for the New York Times Magazine for many, many, many years. Somebody once said, you know, Bill Safire, there's a good Bill and there's a bad Bill. You know, the good Bill writes the language column, and the bad Bill writes those political essays during the week that are syndicated. You know, he's very conservative. But I had some truck with him over the years, and I wrote some guest columns when he was on vacation for the magazine. I got into this, as I said, with the job at KPRO. It got me very involved in vocabulary. I started to find out about dictionaries. I found out that I love dictionaries. I started collecting dictionaries. I was just fascinated with word history, with usage, and of course with pronunciation, which was something that my mother, see, it always goes back to your mother,
right.
Doesn't
it's
it?
It's always your mother's fault.
My mother was such a word buff, and boy, did she correct our pronunciation.
Well, good for her.
I mean, in the introduction to Zoo, There's No Zoo in Zoology, which is out of print now. You can only get my big book. But in the introduction, I recounted a little story about how I'd come home from college one time, and I'd used the word that is spelled F-L-A-C-C-I-D, and I pronounced it flaccid. And my mother just froze, and she looked at me and said, "That's flaccid, dear." And I said, "Get out of here. My English professor says flaccid." And she says, "Well, your English professor is wrong." And I went to the dictionary, and by God, she was right, you know? And from that point on, I said, I vowed I'm going to outmother my mother on pronunciation. Mm-hmm. So that was certainly part of it, you know, the Freudian angle. And then I got that gig at KPBS doing, A Word to the Wise. And, you know, I figured, well, in those days, the sort of word lore section of the bookstores, it was just beginning. There were only a few volumes there. So it was kind of a wide open niche.
Right.
Not a niche, but a niche. And
I learned something else.
And I like to teach. So I thought, why don't I just take this love of language and dictionaries and this feeling of teachership, mm-hmm. and do it on the radio and then publish some books. And because there was an opening there for it.
Right.
It's much more competitive now, mm-hmm. if you can believe that. After 30 years in the business, I really can't get a decent advance anymore, and a lot of people turn me down because they think they can't sell that kind of book anymore.
Isn't it also because the publishing world has changed?
Totally.
Yeah, it's disappeared in many ways.
Publishers are running scared. Mm-hmm. They've backed off the ridiculous advances they used to pay. Too bad.
Which were nice, yes. Yeah,
but even with the lower advances, you sometimes can't earn it out because they're not pushing your book. If you're the mid-list, the so-called mid-list mm-hmm. author, not that, you know, 0.1% that gets on the bestseller mm-hmm. list. If you're sort of part of that solid middle of the road pack that is supposed mm-hmm. to be making the publisher money, make the nut for mm-hmm. the publisher. You can really get left behind, though. You know, I had my last two books were with St. Martin's, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you remember Arthur Somm, who was the books editor for the Tribune and the old San Diego Tribune, and then for the San Diego Union, and then the Union Tribune for many years. He's an old friend of mine, and he said, you know, St. Martin's Griffin, they publish so many books. It's like they're throwing spaghetti at a wall and whatever sticks, you know, that's what they go with. And what falls down, my books, you know, they don't worry about it.
Well, I know you've used your gift also to help kids prepare for SAT and ACT tests. So how did you turn this wordsmithery, I just made that up, into helping kids prepare for those tests?
Well, I came up with, along with an old friend, a college buddy named Joseph Elliott, we came up with the concept of the novel approach to the SAT and then mm-hmm. later the ACT. The idea was that I knew that vocabulary is learned chiefly by reading. You know, once you learn to read, that's where you're going to learn 95% of your words.
Right.
So if you're not a reader, you're not really adding words to your vocabulary.
Which is an issue, isn't it?
It's a huge issue. Like, talk mm-hmm. to any librarian and they'll tell you all about reluctant readers mm-hmm. and the books that they have for reluctant readers. For example, those R.L. Stine Goosebumps series books. Librarians love them. Not because they're well written or anything. It's just that people who don't want to read, this is mostly, say, middle school boys, they will read those books.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important to, you know, get these reluctant readers reading. Anyway, so the novel approach was an idea that came out of this understanding that we learn words from reading, we learn them in context. And everything out there that purports to teach you words for the SAT, or words for life, for that matter,
mm-hmm.
doesn't teach it effectively. They give you a word, they give you a definition, and then maybe they give you a sentence or two, and that's supposed to be the context. And then you're supposed to memorize this? You're supposed to cram this before the test? No, this didn't seem like the right way to go. So, mm-hmm. you know, we came up with the commercial angle, the hook, which was, hey, these are the words from the tests that you need to know for the test. But the concept itself was just teacherly. It was, you need to learn words. Vocabulary will make you a smarter, better person, you know, have better critical faculties, etc., more successful in life, however you want to put it. And so we wrote a novel. It was called Tooth and Nail. And we bold-faced the SAT words in the story, a full-length novel, and then in the back of the book, these bold-faced words were defined in a glossary. And I did that again some years later with Test of Time, which was a kind of a time travel comedy adventure starring Mark Twain, who goes to the future, to our near future. Right when he's finished writing Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, he has the manuscript, but it hasn't been published yet. So the manuscript and Twain get lost in the future and have to find their way back.
That's a great concept.
And those were successful projects because I think in the writing business, you can somewhat gauge your success by how many people imitate you.
Right.
How many people rip you off and knock you out? Right?
Uh-huh.
So I started to go to bookstores and see that all these people were doing knockoffs on Tooth and Nail and Test of Time. And one of them, oh, got me so angry. You wouldn't believe it. It was a paraphrase.
You're kidding.
Of The Wizard of Oz. I mean, I am not kidding. Take The Real Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum and put it up against this story, right? And it was a total paraphrase with the SAT words dropped in here and there. I could not believe it. I thought that's the stupidest, dumbest, laziest thing I've ever seen. And then it got worse. I looked at the introduction and the guy who wrote this thing, whose name I have thankfully forgotten, this guy claimed that he had invented the idea of a novel approach.
Oh.
He had claimed it. I swear, I have rarely, maybe three times in my life, felt that I needed to tear a book's pages from its spine and feed them to the flames. But that was one of those times.
Wow. So plagiarism and to add insult to injury.
It wasn't plagiarism. It was
close to it, though.
You know, it's laziness. Just lazy when
lazy.
You know,
yes.
If you're going to rip somebody off, try to do it better.
Well, you made it fun to study for the exams. And I think that's the big thing that you did is because instead of boring people with this task, you made it fun. And if a person isn't going to make it fun, I don't see how they can imitate what you were doing when they missed the whole concept of you came up with an original story. And,
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, East County Magazine.
The interesting thing, Raina, is that you do something once and everybody loves it. You do it again and they think you're a schmuck. You're not going to believe this. The first book comes out, Tooth and Nail comes out, and everybody goes, wow, that's a great idea. Why hasn't anybody thought of that before? And all we were doing was trying to make it more fun. You know,
right.
I don't know if it works. I think it works, but the idea, I mean, for the test, it should work. But the main idea is that this is the way you learn words, okay? So pay attention to what you're reading. And one of my mantras is look for words you don't know and look them up. Because I can't tell you how many people would say, oh, well, I just read around the word and figure it out from context. No, you can't do that. Yeah, you can take the guess. That's good. But look it up because what if you guess wrong? You know, and what if you guess wrong and say, oh, well, that's what I think it means. And then you start using the word in a wrong way with a wrong definition. You built a vocabulary full of wrong definitions. You know, I remember one book signing where a mother came up to me and said, you know, I'm old enough. I'm experienced enough as a reader. I can figure words out from context. I said, really? No, because sometimes context is ambiguous, you know. And I said, do you mind if I give you a little test, a one-sentence test.
Oh, you don't want a word test from Charlie Elster.
So I said, here's a sentence with an SAT word, very typical SAT word. After her exciting night on the town, she felt enervated. I said, what does enervated mean? And this mother thought about it for a moment, and she said, stimulated, energized after her exciting night in the town. I said, no, it means the exact opposite. But it sounds like energized.
Uh-huh.
But it's not, and the context was ambiguous.
Right. Good example. I don't know if I would have passed that one either. I read that your favorite word is, I'm going to say it wrong, resistentialism?
I'll help you.
Okay. Why is that your favorite word, and do you have any least favorite word?
Sure. Resistentialism was a word coined by the British humorist Paul Jennings in 1948, I think, in an article in the Spectator magazine. And he was doing a send-up of existentialism. So his article, his essay was all about, not Jean-Paul Sartre, but Jean-Marie Ventre. And how this guy was a betrousered and bespectacled, you know, member of the French philosophers. And he, you know, and so he's come up with, he posits that this guy comes up with resistentialism as opposed to existentialism. Existentialism is, you know, we're all out there, you know, and everybody's responsible for their actions, but we just, there's no sort of governing agency and we don't know what we're doing, right? Well, with resistentialism, it's all about things. And it takes the Latin word for thing, which is res, R-E-S, and it combines it with existentialism. And the definition is, things are against us.
Ooh. That's...
Think about it. Spiteful behavior manifested by inanimate objects.
My computer is often spiteful.
Oh, computers are, yeah. They're
my cell phone.
Yeah, but I maintain that the quintessential resistentialist object is plastic wrap.
Yes. Or when you try to open a box, even, you know, when a container, like, just, I was trying to open batteries and I was getting very frustrated. I couldn't get it open. The package. You
take your hammer out and
hit the battery. What's your least favorite word?
Well, one more thing on resistentialism of interest. Now, the Oxford English Dictionary finally decided to include resistentialism in its pages, which are, by the way, all online now. They've decided no longer to publish it in paper, and they, you know, it's easier to update and everything, right? So when they put resistentialism online, oh, and by the way, everybody should know that you check with your local library, because your library may have a subscription to the Oxford English Dictionary. You know, it's very expensive to buy it in print. But if your library has it, you can access it free.
Right.
Okay, so that's a really nice resource. So the OED puts in resistentialism, and it defines it initially as a sham philosophy about how objects are conspiring against us. And I thought, sham? Sham?
Have you ever used plastic wrap?
Anybody who's ever had to call a plumber on a Sunday morning with overnight house guests, you know, knows that this is not a sham philosophy, okay? So, you know, so some years go by, and I was very pleased and vindicated to discover that they had updated their entry for resistentialism, and now, not only did they revise the definition, taking out the sham and making it, you know, a real philosophy, but they also had quoted one of my books where I had discussed
really?
It. Yeah. Wow. I'm in the OED.
What's the quote? Do you remember?
Oh, it's, yeah, it's something about, my daughter Carmen. She was very young in those days, and, it was my book, There's a Word for It, which is subtitled A Grandiloquent Guide to Life. And it's all about, there are lots of books out there on unusual words, but this one is about unusual words that are unusually useful. So, you know, they would, if you had to explain the concept, you know, without the word, it would take many, many common words to get it across. But, so I was saying, here are just a bunch of words that bang, you know, hit the nail on the head. And I was talking about Carmen, and I was relating how one time she came to me crying. And she said, she pointed to the other room and she said, that chair in there, it bumped me. And you have to go tell it to stop.
Ooh. Oh, that's perfect.
And so they quoted a little
something. Oh, that's great. There. That's great. So what is your least favorite word?
Oh, least favorite. I would say my two least favorite words. Now, this may be hard to believe, but I have boycotted these words since probably more than 30 years, since I criticized them on A Word to the Wise, my radio segment way back when on KPBS. Unique is the first one, and impact is the second one.
Oh, and they're used a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Overused for unique.
Yeah, so I imagine yourself going through life never using unique or impact again.
You can't listen to politics.
My argument is, it's an old one. Unique comes from the Latin unus, one, single, soul.
Right.
So use it for something that is unique, not somewhat unique or almost unique or truly unique or whatever, you know, you can't really modify that word. It's got to be for something that's, here's my preferred substitute for it, sui generis, Latin meaning of its own kind, one of a kind. Okay.
I think that's too hard to spell for most of us.
Yeah, and it's two words. But with impact, it just drives me nuts. I mean, the noun, okay, it means a collision, right? I'm okay with that. The verb means to smash, to have a collision.
Right.
It's a very powerful word. The line I always used talking about it was, why use a pile driver when a putty knife will do the work?
And totally agree.
What the heck is wrong with saying effect or influence?
Right.
That's what we used before.
It
sounds
fancier.
But now everything is impact, 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 bang, bang, bang. You know?
It's become jargon, really.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to your other hat for a minute here. You've mentioned the different radio shows. I know you've done hundreds of them. But you were, in 1998, you, along with Richard Lederer, became the founding co-hosts of the public radio show Away with Words. And I know that went, I think, for 6 years. And you've also been on NPR's Talk of the Nation, Weekend Edition, All Things Considered. So how do you prepare for and handle the answer man role in live radio? You don't have time to do research. How do you do that?
With Away with Words, we started as a live show and did that for 2 years at least. And then we went to what they call the call-out format. So if you remember a show like Car Talk, the way that works is you set up your recording date on a Wednesday or a Thursday or whatever it is. And then you have your 800 number and people are calling in with these questions and they're leaving them on voicemail. So then you call them, you know, you call them, your producer calls them and invites them to come on the show during your studio session. So that's the way we did it, and the way most shows do it. But when you're doing it, you know, after a couple of years, but when you're doing it live, boy, it's exciting. You know, something about live radio. So when I do these, shows, and I, for example, I'm on KOA Denver every month now, on the Mandy Connell show, and you just have to really be on your toes. So when I get ready for this, and we did this with Away with Words in the beginning, is I have a stack of books. I'm a book person. You know, yes, I have my computer on, and yes, I go to my Oxford English Dictionary subscription with the San Diego Public Library, so I have that up, you know. But I've got the Webster's New International Second Edition, the Random House Unabridged Dictionary Second Edition. I've got usage manuals. I've got my books, you know, all kind of laid out, ready to go. A pad of paper, pen, so I can write the caller's name down. Because you know, the best thing to do when you're a guest like that is, the host will say, and now, Raina, you're on, you know, KNSJ. So, you write down Raina, you know, so you can say, Raina, that's a really excellent question.
Right. Make it personal.
Yeah. I mean, radio, I always was taught, is an interaction between you and one other person. You know, and in acting, it's something like that too. You know, they teach you to talk to the clock on the back wall, but really what you want to do is talk to the you. Hey, you, I'm talking to you.
So it's the same connection.
Yeah, you're speaking to one person, not, you know, you can say, of course, it's okay to say your listeners or all of you out there, but you know, really you're talking to one person, and that's the intimacy of radio, and live radio brings out the adrenaline in that conversation.
But you love it.
I love it. Yeah.
Did you ever get stuck where you couldn't answer
absolutely.
A question?
All the time.
You just get stuck in
all the time. You
on
know,
air.
And so you goof around, you know, you're flipping pages in the book, you know, saying, I think the answer's in here. And meanwhile you're talking, you know, it's the ultimate multitasking, and you're saying, yeah, that's a really good question. Flip. Damn it, where the hell's the answer?
You know? And you do. I remember that you sounded very animated.
Oh, yeah, you know, you know, it's exciting and
like having a
and
lot of coffee.
And on commercial radio, of course, you have to worry about the commercial breaks, you know. So you know that the answer can't be too long. So sometimes I've had to resort to something like, well, that's such a good question. I'm going to have to do a little research and I'll have the answer for you after
the
break.
Commercial.
and then, you know, during the break, wow, bang, bang, I'm just going crazy looking for it. And usually I can come up with answers within a minute or two. If it's unfamiliar, yeah.
It's really, really interesting.
And then, you know, if it's really bad, I'll tell people now with websites and everything, I'll say, this one I'm going to post on my website, so please visit.
Okay. So what are you working on now, Charlie? I'm going to have you read something, but mm-hmm. before you do that, what are you working on now? What's your next book?
Well, we spoke earlier about how difficult it is these days to get your stuff published, even when you have a track record,
mm-hmm.
as I do. So the thing I really have been wanting to do is compile all this stuff that I've done over the past 30 years, reviews, essays, speeches, light verse, heavy verse, you name it, letters. And I just wanted to kind of cull the best of that from a career that's, well, I hope it's still mid-career, and put it together in a book. And my agent said, there is no way anybody's going to buy this. So she directed me to something called the Amazon Kindle White Glove Program. You ever heard of that?
I think so, but refresh my memory.
Well, you can publish your book on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Anybody can do mm-hmm. that, right? But if you're part of the White Glove Program, it means that Amazon has said your agent is selected to be part of this program and we'll give you a better deal and we'll give you a little more white glove treatment. And then you go through your agent posts your book. You still have to design your book and be your own copy editor and the whole thing. But you get a much better royalty arrangement and it's sort of shepherded for you. You know.
It's a special list.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it feels a little bit more like actual publishing, you know, at least so far.
Traditional publishing.
Yeah. A little more like traditional publishing. So I'm going to experiment with that. And this compilation I'm going to call The Enthusiasms of Charles Harrington Elster.
It sounds like fun. If it's any as fun as talking to you.
Well, it's stuff that my readers, mostly will not have seen.
Mm-hmm.
They'll see different sides of me as a writer, not just language, but life and literature and all that stuff, too.
So why don't you read us something? Give
sure.
us a couple of examples, samples from your books.
Well, I have just a little tidbit here. I have two tidbits, but the first tidbit is from my book, Verbal Advantage, from the introduction. And you know, people often want to know, well, you write about language. Well, what's that all about? How'd you come to do that?
And, you know, like I asked.
Yeah, yeah. So this fleshes that out a little bit. I say, gotta get the glasses out here. Hang on. I say, let me tell you a bit about myself. I'm an author, journalist, and radio commentator who specializes in writing about the English language. Like most serious writers, I care deeply about words, where they came from, what they mean, how they are used and pronounced. In fact, I think it's fair to say that I'm afflicted with a terminal passion for words. Allow me to explain how I contracted this most pleasant malady. For as long as I can remember, I've been in love with the beauty, rhythm, subtlety, and power of language. And from an early age, I aspired to a career working with words. Like many writers, I acquired my affection for words from my parents. Although both my father and mother are retired professional musicians, they have always been avid readers with a fine ear for language as well as music. When I was young, they read me stories and poems at bedtime, and as I grew older, they encouraged me to read widely on my own. I often had lengthy discussions with them about books and language, and whenever we had a question or a dispute about a word, the hefty, unabridged dictionary in our living room was the final authority. The consequence of this verbally intensive upbringing was that two parents who loved language but made music for a living wound up with a son who loves music but makes his living with words.
Oh, perfect. That's a very complete explanation. Thank you for sharing that.
That's
and well said.
Kind of my raison d'etre. You know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I have another selection, if I may.
Yes.
It's the opening of my vocabulary building novel, Test of Time, the one that stars Mark Twain, time traveling, with his unpublished, as yet unpublished manuscript of Huck Finn. And I'm choosing this because I like it as a piece of writing that I did. And it's also, I want to say, this is my answer to that turkey, Elmore Leonard, who said, never start with the weather. You remember that admonition?
Yeah, uh-huh.
It was in one of his little books on how to write or how not to write. You know.
Yeah.
Never start with the weather.
Never say never.
And I thought, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You can start with the weather if you do something with it. And what I'm doing here in these opening paragraphs of Test of Time is I'm starting with the big picture. The weather is the big picture. And then I'm, imagine a camera. I'm coming down and down and down and down until I get to Twain's house in Hartford, Connecticut, and, you know, him and his family. So I'm narrowing the focus.
It's like a bird's eye view. Yeah. You zoom.
And the other thing that the astute listener and reader will notice is that I am parodying in this opening the end of James Joyce's famous story, The Dead. Okay. Which uses this line, snow was general all over Ireland.
Oh, I love that.
Famous line in that story. So here we go. The week before Christmas, 1883. For once, the newspapers were right. Snow was general all over New England. The storm had begun quietly in the mute, impenetrable darkness before dawn. At first, there was almost no wind and only a light, silvery dusting of snow. Then, after a morning in which the sun struggled in vain to assert itself through an oppressive layer of clouds, the wind announced the impending blizzard in howling, stinging gusts. Soon after came the heavy snow, falling swiftly and abundantly in flakes the size of goose feathers. By nightfall, a deep white blanket had covered all. And still the wind wailed, and the incessant snow swirled and fell. It fell on majestic Mount Katahdin, at the northern terminus of the Appalachian Trail in Maine, and on the stony bald summit of Camel's Hump in the Green Mountains of Vermont. It fell on the dreary, somber mill towns of western Massachusetts, and on the opulent, ostentatious mansions of the affluent robber barons in Newport, Rhode Island. It fell on picturesque hamlets and villages, on myriad farmhouses and barns and barren fields, on the crooked crosses and gravestones of countless churchyard cemeteries. It fell and vanished like steam into the dark, inscrutable waters of the Connecticut River. It was falling, too, upon every one of the many gables and dormers and turrets of the fanciful, eclectic, and eccentric brick house at 351 Farmington Avenue in Hartford, Connecticut, on the western edge of town, where an American writer, the most famous writer in the land, lived with his devoted wife and three young daughters.
That is lovely. I love the sun trying to assert itself.
That's called a personification.
Yes, yes, it's really very poetic.
Thank you.
Well, Charlie, any last words from the man of words for our interview here?
An anecdote I love to relate to young and upcoming writers, especially wannabe folks, because those folks always ask the same two questions when you're doing a speaking event. And years ago, I attended a speaking event by William Murray, who had written for The New Yorker for many years. He lived in Los Angeles mostly, but toward the end of his life, he moved down to San Diego to be near the Del Mar racetrack because a lot of people don't remember him, as a racetrack novelist, but that was his other big thing. He was sort of the Avis to the Hertz of Dick Francis, who wrote about 5,000
right.
of them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But William Murray was a wonderfully literate person and kind of a mentor to me. And I attended one of his events and somebody asks him, sure enough, afterward, well, Mr. Murray, what advice do you have for aspiring writers? You always get that question. And he says, I'll never forget, two word answer. Marry well.
Right. So is that.
Yeah. And then the follow up question was, of course, and what motivates you as a writer, or how do you stay disciplined as a writer? You always get that question too, right? And Murray said, I just check my bank balance.
Right. I thought you were going to say I'm
that's
hungry.
My advice.
You know. Okay.
You want to be a writer, just check your bank balance and marry well, not necessarily in that order.
Okay. Well, Charlie, thank you so much for joining us. It was wonderful to have you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here, Raina. Thank you.
For more information on Charles Harrington Elster and his work, please visit his website at charlesharringtonelster.com. You can also contact him on Twitter at Charles H. Elster @ElsterWords. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you've been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
San Diegans living with Alzheimer's can now receive free GPS devices under the Wandering Prevention Pilot Program started by Alzheimer's San Diego. The program, which was funded by a $10,000 county grant, will allow Alzheimer's San Diego to give 100 families a free Great Call GPS device. Alzheimer's disease can cause someone, even in the early stages, to become confused or disoriented, and this can pose serious safety issues. Today, there are more than 62,000 San Diegans living with Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, and 6 in 10 of them will wander at some point. Unfortunately, many families are unaware of the risks of wandering and do not have a plan in place. Each family in the program will receive a free Great Call device, accessories, and 3 months of service. They will also receive continuing support and follow-up from the master's-level social workers at Alzheimer's San Diego. Supervisor Greg Cox, who proposed funding for the project, says, "This program is going to save lives and give families tremendous peace of mind. We are making the devices available to families who otherwise couldn't afford them. This local project is supported by the San Diego County Sheriff's Department, which is seeing an increasing number of cases involving wandering patients with dementia. The Wandering Pilot Program will work with the Sheriff's Take Me Home Program, which allows family members to register photos of Alzheimer's and other dementia patients so that law enforcement will have access to critical information to help return the person safely. For more information about the Wandering Prevention Pilot Program or dementia-related safety concerns, you can visit ALZD.org or call 858-492-4400. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Kim Cooney.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Corey Clement, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.